Good morning. Welcome to Jobs and Economic Development Committee. We don't have a quorum yet, so we'll start with House File 914. We're not going to do the House File 2161, so 1019 for Bentley.
We're starting with 1019?
Yep, House File 1019, Representative Bentley. Welcome, Representative Lin. So this will be informational hearing. Once we have a quorum, we'll move the bill for possible inclusion. So please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I appreciate hearing this bill this morning, House File 1019. And this bill would appropriate $1.5 million in fiscal year 2020 and also in 2021 for a biennial total of $3 million. To support the small business development centers around the state for the purpose of helping them with business transition planning and to match federal dollars for small business development centers. Business transition planning included in the bill is succession planning for next generation business leaders, providing a venue for existing business owners and aspiring proprietors to exchange information. This aspect of the bill does allow services to be targeted to economically disadvantaged communities to spread business opportunities out to people who have not traditionally had such opportunities. The transition planning in the bill would also provide information and counseling to both existing business owners and prospective business owners on business transitioning and succession planning. Mr. Chair, committee members, this bill is important. I have carried it in the past, and we're looking right now at about 60% of existing businesses changing hands, changing ownership within the next 10 years. So this bill, these dollars would really help to keep these businesses open as they go through those transitions, and most importantly, to keep Main Street businesses open in our communities for the next generation. And so at this time, I can stand for questions or let the testifier give some comments.
Please state your name and proceed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matt Magnus. I am the executive director of the West Central Minnesota SBDC, so the host institution, as all SBDC regions have for me, is Concordia College and specifically the Offutt School of Business. And so I am here both as an SBDC professional and experienced consultant, that sort of thing, and the director, but also appreciate representing our host, Concordia College. And, of course, I'm offering testimony on this House File Bill 1019. You should have a handout in front of you that says business succession planning, and there were a few other references, but hopefully that's in front of you. No one goes through the work and the risk and the sacrifice of starting a business without hoping it will last and building a business and the value it represents so that it endures is the dream that most substantially motivates entrepreneurs. Yet in many businesses, too little of that work goes into determining who will take over from the founding owners who are ready to retire or move on. We face a tremendous number of people in that position over the next few years as the baby boomer generation starts to retire in more rapid numbers. Recent studies show that 67% of the current American business market is owned by baby boomers. That's more than two-thirds, and they're set to transition over the next 15 years. And Minnesota has more than 300,000 small businesses. 100,000 plus of those have employees. So the idea of this business transition isn't just the business owner themselves and their particular interest, but is certainly all the employees and how they impact the community. More recent statistics have shown that owners aren't transitioning as quickly as anticipated immediately following this past Great Recession of 2008. There are many possible reasons why this isn't happening. The devaluation resulting from the recession may be a certain factor, healthier lifestyles that allow people to actually work longer, but maybe most predominantly, quite frankly, a lack of planning. In the end, all of these businesses will transition. There is not a doubt that it will happen. Whether it happens orderly and in a way for it to actually be a continuing and go forward business that's functioning and adding value to the community, that's a big challenge. The demographic shift significantly impacts all communities as well. More so, smaller and rural communities are impacted to a greater degree if these individual businesses do not transition. Business owners aren't just the employers. They're often deeply involved in the fabric of the community. They're community leaders. They sit on city councils. They help the community move forward in a lot of different ways. These shifts also mean that a transfer of that community leadership and that community influence is at risk if these owners step back and new owners are not actually taking their place. In addition, 80 or 90% of most owners' financial assets, their net worth, is actually tied up in the business. So in order for them to retire as foreseen, the idea of a new buyer for that business is really crucial and at a value that hopefully is commensurate with the business performance. For a business working out a succession plan, if they don't have a succession plan, that can really invite a lot of disruption, uncertainty, and conflict, and indeed the very viability of the business is at risk if it doesn't have some sort of plan that can help it be in a position to carry forward. The strategic succession planning becomes even more complicated with family issues, so family transition oftentimes has a lot of other legacy, birthright, emotion, and interpersonal dynamics that get part of this mix. What we're seeing more so is a trend towards third parties becoming the next owner of the business, in contrast to simply a family member, as what maybe had been traditional 30 or 40 years ago. Every apparent simple succession scenario can become very complex with family issues that mingle with business concerns. The ultimate goal of succession planning is to understand the value of the business, to preserve that value, and its future growth potential in that community, as well as to pass it forward intact to another owner. Without successful business transition, local economies will erode, employees lose jobs, the communities lose access to goods and services, and as a result, things like buildings go empty on Main Street. And that's a real bad answer oftentimes for this unprecedented amount of business transition that we face over the next 15 years. Even companies that are thought of as high performers, that have been around for years, are run professionally and well, oftentimes are planning poorly. Statistics right now show that only about one in every four businesses has anything resembling a business plan, and fewer have them actually written down. There isn't a real good reason to justify the common oversight of not planning for a transition. Some business leaders would say they're just too caught up in the day-to-day challenges. Some have an aversion, if you will, to the idea that they are ever going to not be part of that business and just really don't want to think about that. But on the other hand, some assume that it'll just sort of happen in a natural way. But others underestimate the true task involved with trying to harvest the value they put into the business and what the business is that they built, in order to try to, if you will, cash out as well as successfully have that business have a future with a new owner in that community. There's a bullet list of some things here that, they sort of mix, but I think I reference those. They feel like it's too early to plan, yet some people with health issues or something, end up planning in a big hurry, and then it's in disarray, and they end up not being able to do that very effectively. They get a little scared by the whole idea of being complex and intimidating. They can't find adequate advice and tools, which is a big part of it. Selling a business is oftentimes not something these people have done ever before. So the idea of how to navigate those waters, how to have the value of the business preserved, how to do that in a way where they can come out at the other end and still oftentimes live up to an expectation they have for that company to still be part of that community going forward. Those are things that are definitely issues for us to address. Interested business buyers are also facing financing challenges, in many cases due to the undervaluation of the business based off of accounting procedures. Existing business owners oftentimes optimize their financial statements in order to minimize tax burden. It's a natural and, frankly, ingrained professional activity of CPAs, accountants, to try to actually help business owners minimize tax burden. That means their financials are oftentimes showing less profitability, therefore harder for those financials to support financing from the normal lender community involved with a new owner pursuing that business. The reasons people avoid succession planning aren't as important as the reasons they should embrace it. But like I said, they need a lot of guidance, they need tools, and they need resources. Succession planning is, in fact, a multidisciplinary process, and it's oftentimes estimated that it should be done over 3 to 5 years in advance of that transition happening so that the planning can go well. There are many benefits for companies and owners who plan properly and strategically in order to have a transition of management and ownership. Some of those things, protecting the value of the business, creating a smooth transition team for management and for other stakeholders, generating a potential income for retirement and disability for the seller, enhancing the net worth of the business to the future owner and the community, reducing or deferring the potential tax impact when it comes to estate planning or estate planning for spouse and family, creating strategic direction for the future business growth so that it's poised for a new owner to actually have success, ability to retain control of the process instead of having someone else make decisions. If I get forced into a health issue, very likely my business transition is in jeopardy because it's a surprise. It accelerates timelines. The people trying to represent the business maybe aren't as familiar with it, and it puts the whole idea of that value in that business being successfully transitioned at risk. Statistics show that only 20 to 30% of the businesses that go to market today actually sell, and it's because of some of these challenges that I've just mentioned. That means 80% are left without solid options for how to harvest any value or wealth out of the business and ensure economic continuity into the next generation. An owner who is ready with an attractive business greatly increases the odds of the business surviving to the next owner if they've done planning. The question is, how ready are business owners? Small business development centers work with small businesses every day. We're efficient, we're effective business advisors in place. In fact, I myself have been working quite closely with many buy-sell transactions. The amount of buy-sell instances of transactions for us as consultants and advisors is going up rapidly. So we're seeing a lot of this activity. And in many cases, we're coupling that activity to be supported with local communities who are, in fact, identifying the business owners that are at or close to retirement age and trying to help with broader community planning as well as the idea of helping these individuals. SBDCs can help because we're already there in the neighborhoods today. We provide no-cost, confidential one-on-one consultation if you're not familiar with SBDCs. And as a result, we're accessible to everyone. We feel as though we can extend a hand and help them on a one-to-one basis. We provide specific training to assist business owners to prepare for that effective transition plan, identify sources of potential buyers, work with owners considering selling, even if they happen to be pursuing things like employee stock option programs or something like that that help them figure out ways that they transition that business. The SBDCs do a lot of work in business valuation. We help coordinate multidisciplinary teams of attorneys, accountants, other advisors that are part of the fabric that make up the ability for a transaction to happen and that's well prepared. We provide the opportunity for buyers and sellers to meet and have discussions We help new owners secure financing. That's a big part, oftentimes, of the role we play. It's a very critical part, and new owners have a difficult time with that. New owners establish we help new owners with their business planning and expectations, and we work with those local communities in order to talk about, plan for, and pursue the transition plans, not only for individual businesses, but sort of across the community. However, SBDCs and the volume of sheer business transitions that are going to happen, we need additional financial resources and transition-specific programs and training that have significant impact on resolving business succession issues. The bill will provide that framework and necessary financial resources. Thank you very much for your time. I would certainly want to invite questions, and I'll note that we have Deeds Deputy Commissioner Kevin McKinnon, as well as the State SBDC Director Bruce Strong, here in the audience this morning that could contribute to any of those questions or answers as well.
Thank you so much, Mr. McGinnis. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Now we do have a quorum, and I will entertain a motion for us to approve the minutes. Mm-hmm. Representative Moran moves the minutes. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. The minutes have been approved. So now officially move House File 1019 to be included for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And with that, I would like to open up for questions. Representative Ganta.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, will this money be sufficient to get the federal match for all the SBDCs?
It would likely cover the federal match for the state of Minnesota's match. Yes.
Very important.
Any other questions from the members? Representative Hogan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just curious, how do you guys do outreach to the businesses that have owners over 65? Or how? I came in a little late, so I apologize if you covered that.
No worries.
Mr. McMahon.
With that, our normal mode of operation is to, yes, do outreach from a standpoint of making ourselves available. We oftentimes do training events or presentations or other things that invite people to at least identify who is the SBDC, understand that it is no cost, which is usually one of those real significant questions they have. And then they actually have to take a very intentional step to become a client with us, to basically raise their hand and say, yes, I'd love to work with the SBDC to help me. So there is sort of a mutual connection there that's made. But we're oftentimes working in communities. I'll give an example of a process I did. It happened in Barnesville, Minnesota. It's written up in a couple of the Minnesota Extension rural business transition articles and things. And the example was that the economic development person and the Barnesville City Council were looking to help with this business transition planning. They saw a lot of aging business owners, and a lot of them were having questions. But additionally, what we did was they actually made a list. They went basically down the list of all the businesses in town, and they made a list of those businesses that had even, you know, close to retirement kind of age owners. And they invited all of them to be part of a series of business workshops that we presented to them. So I presented on business valuation. I also presented on sort of the buy-sell process on how it works. They had a couple of other presentations on process and on financial financing, other elements of that. And so there were a series of different topics that were very germane to their situation. And the city was involved with organizing who they invited to all those workshops. We presented at all those workshops and then ended up working with a number of those business owners as we tried to put their business on the marketplace. We're not technically acting as brokers. We're acting on the interest of the owner to help them be prepared, help them have documentation so he can actually pass that to a potential buyer. And so that's an example of how it happens, and it is hand in glove oftentimes with the various, especially in real small communities, it ends up being a very hand in glove kind of relationship.
Go ahead.
Is that something that you're looking to replicate then with some of this funding?
That certainly is one example of ways to replicate. I will say that we are always looking for new options, and the reason why is that, and I did allude to it, the existing owners are still being very apprehensive of raising their hands that their businesses are for sale. There is a common fear that they will announce that they may, that if they announce they're going to sell their business, their employees will leave, their business will suffer, and it'll degrade the value. We don't typically see that in the marketplace. Actually, we see the contrast, that if an owner is actually forthcoming and planning and saying, look, my employees, I'm going to try to sell this business and I expect that all you are intact as part of it, that's a very common expectation of a buyer as well. And in those situations, it's really, you know, something that that disclosure probably is as helpful, certainly not a detractor. But the biggest challenge we have is having existing owners be willing to raise their hands, identify themselves, even to attend a session that says, I might sell my business. They kind of seem to not want to show up at those. So we're trying to be more and more creative about naming the session they're coming to. An example would be we're actually having a lot more success right now naming sessions business valuation. And it's all about the owner just being informed what might be the value of your business, how do we calculate that, how can you have an idea, because oftentimes that's one of the first questions they have is they don't have any idea how much my Main Street, you know, plumbing business might be worth, and so where to price it, even if they were to pursue that. So those are examples, but we're still trying to be creative, especially we have on the buyer side, lots of people say, I'm looking to buy a business. On the seller side, it's still hard to get them to come to the table and be, especially in a public situation, willing to discuss it.
Representative Mora?
I'm going to pass.
You'll pass. Representative Shaw?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious, how would you guys, what businesses or what capacity would they have to be considered a small business? I'm just curious.
Well, generally speaking, these are businesses. You could use a couple of measures. You could use a measure like size of employees. This is most commonly businesses that are under about 50 employees. It can depend on the industry, of course, because restaurants employ dramatically more people, or home health care or something might be more people. But, 50 might be a good cutoff point, although we don't use that. SBDCs do not use that as a cutoff point. We use the small business definition, which is like, you know, a 500 employee number or smaller. So there's a lot of latitude in terms of how we engage. But when I'm talking about the businesses that are transitioning, very commonly sort of in that 50 employee or less category, and probably in the, 15 million or less in terms of top line revenue as a profile.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, to testify. I'm just curious, is there information where I can find out where a lot of these small businesses
Mr. are? Mr. Megan, go ahead.
I mean, not necessarily a list of the names of the businesses, but census data, all sorts of other data actually is part of the makeup of the the numbers and where they potentially are, and one of the references and the handouts that you have is from a source that I'm not personally as familiar with, but they're thought of as particularly reputable, the Exit Planning Institute. They do national work. What I gave you as an example was a study they did a couple years ago, and it was focused on the Minnesota Twin Cities metro area at large, so it really did not focus on as much outstate. But it specifically gives a number of profiles and stats and examples of the census reference numbers are embedded in that to some degree. So that's one that I think is good. But there are quite a few, and I also included one from the Extension Service because it was more focused on rural.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just asking because, one day I might like to own one of these businesses, so you know, I'm going to look them up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Representative. See no other questions from the members. The House File 1019 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. To Representative Ben Lean.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I appreciate your time and attention on the bill today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
We will now move to House File 914. President Posnick, go ahead, please, and move the file for possible conclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I would like to move House File 914 for possible inclusion.
Please proceed.
Before we proceed, there is a author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that I'd like to move as well.
A1 amendment has been moved. Will you please explain further the A1 amendment?
Certainly. The amendment, let's see here. It just makes a couple technical corrections. It talks about 46.046, that's defined in statute, so it wasn't determined not needed. And then 46.048 and 216C.437, subdivision 12, were previously omitted by accident when the statute was passed in 2017.
See no other discussions. We'd like all those in favor of A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? See none. A1 has been adopted, so please proceed with the bill.
Okay, thank you. In 2017, the Minnesota Legislature and the Governor approved a special revenue fund for financial institutions division within the Department of Commerce. And prior to the creation of the special revenue fund, the funds were deposited into the general fund but then appropriated back to the department. The financial institutions division's oversight consists of banks, collection agencies, credit unions, debt service, industrial loan and thrifts, money transmitters, mortgage companies, motor vehicle financing, payday lenders, regulated loan companies, savings and banks, and trust companies. And all these institutions pay into the financial institution's special revenue fund through assessments and examination fees. However, when the special revenue fund was approved in 2017, the non-depository fund, which includes licensing fees, application fees, renewal fees, and et cetera, were not routed into the fund, instead going into the general fund. The justification for the financial institution's special revenue fund was for greater transparency and to make sure that the financial institution's division was funded by all the entities that it regulates. And with me, I have two testifiers. It's a good merging of interest. We have Mr. Joe Witt with the Bankers Association, and also testifying will be Darren McDonald with the Minnesota Mortgage Association. And for clarity, I used to work at a bank and had my own mortgage company, so I'm happy to be a co-author on this bill. And I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Witt. I'm with the Minnesota Bankers Association, and we strongly support this bill. As Representative Kosnick said, this bill is intending to correct a technical drafting error that was made when the Governor's Office and the Department of Commerce moved their funding from the general appropriations process over to a special revenue fund. And the purpose, again, of that change was to ensure stable funding for the department so they can do their job of regulating the entities that were described. And then secondly, within the three classes of entities that I'll talk about in just a second, we wanted to make sure that all of those groups were paying their fair share so that no one type of entity was paying for another group's regulation. Minnesota's state-chartered financial institutions are heavily regulated. When we talk about the types of institutions, we're talking about state-chartered banks and state-chartered credit unions. And I'm saying state-chartered because the national or federally chartered institutions, national banks, and federal credit unions are not regulated by the State Department of Commerce. Generally speaking, when you look at the different types of credit unions and banks in the state, the national banks would be the much larger ones, and the state chartered banks would be the much smaller ones. A lot of our state chartered banks are locally owned, locally managed institutions. So that's the type that we're talking about here with this special revenue fund. The division ensures two things for the banks that they regulate. The first thing that they look at is the safety and soundness of the institutions, and the second thing that they look at is they ensure that banks comply with all applicable consumer protection laws. For the banks and the credit unions, there are regularly scheduled examinations. Every bank and credit union that's subject to the state's regulation is examined in an on-site exam at least once every 18 months. We pay a lot of money to support this high level of regulation that we receive from the Department of Commerce, and it's very, very important work. The non-depository institutions, the ones that are regulated by the Department of Commerce but not the banks and the credit unions, are the ones that Representative Kosnick talked about earlier. It's the mortgage brokers, the mortgage bankers, payday lenders, money transmitters, check cashing facilities, payday lenders, those types of institutions that are non-depository, but they are also subject to regulation by the Department of Commerce. This bill is a technical bill designed to correct the drafting error that occurred back in 2017. When they created the financial institutions special revenue fund, they captured all of the money that was paid by the banks and credit unions, but they did not capture all of the money that was paid by the non-depository institutions. In a drafting error, that money stayed in the general fund, and because there wasn't really another mechanism to appropriate it back to the department once they had the special revenue fund, it was just an omission. It ended up being something of a windfall for the general fund, but it created a big funding issue for the State Department of Commerce. So what this bill does is it includes a long list of fees that are paid by non-depository institutions for their regulatory oversight, and it takes all of those different fees that are not currently in the special revenue fund and transfers them into the special revenue fund, and every year they will be appropriated to the Department of Commerce to pay for the regulation of those industries. We are proud that the Financial Institutions Division is self-funded. We are happy to pay for our regulation, but we also want to make sure that that the department is fully funded. The department does very important work, and it has to be fully funded. So, again, what this bill does is it makes sure that all the fees that are paid by the different types of financial institutions for their regulatory oversight are actually paid to support the division. That's the only way to ensure that the department is properly funded long term, and so we urge you to support this bill and make sure the department has its proper funding and that the special revenue fund is doing what it was supposed to do when they made the change from the general appropriations process. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just reading that there right now there's a $420,000 base appropriation, and there seems to be some discrepancy if this law passed that goes away. So how do you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's part of the non-depository fund's money, and because it wasn't included in the special revenue fund, they've been doing a partial appropriation of their fees back to the department. The purpose of the special revenue fund was to make sure there wasn't that type of appropriation, so it's attempting to collect that money back, but it didn't collect all of it back. It is my understanding that the total amount that was in the there is about 950 in the you can address that, Representative.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I think we have somebody from Commerce that can probably best explain it, so I'll leave it to her. I've got some words I could ramble about, but we'll leave it to the expert.
Please state your name.
If you don't mind. Proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Megan Verde, and I'm Government Affairs Director with the Commerce Department. So, yes, right now we do get a $420 general fund appropriation. I think it would be our assumption that if this bill were to pass, that appropriation would no longer come from the general fund. So the kind of overall balance to the general fund or effect of the general fund would really be 5, 30 instead of the full 950.
Representative Moore.
So, Mrs. Chair, just for clarity, so instead of the 420 base appropriation, it would be 530 now.
Mr. Rodin.
So our assumption would be if this passes and we get the full $950,000 coming in the licensing and renewal fees, excuse me, then we would get rid of the $420,000 general fund appropriation. So then the impact would only be about
$530,000. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cousin.
And Mr. Chair, and then we have our other testifier, and then we can probably be more appropriate time to take other committee questions.
Please proceed. State your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Darren McDonald. I am the president of the Minnesota Mortgage Association. We represent one of the industries affected by this bill. I don't have anything to add beyond what Mr. Witt has stated, but I just wanted to share that the Minnesota Mortgage Association strongly supports this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Any discussion from members? See none. Will you, Representative Kosnick, will you please renew your motion and give us your closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I would renew the motion to lay over House File 914. Actually, I should verify that what we'd like to lay it over. Okay. Lay it over for possible inclusion.
As amended.
As amended. And just that this is more of a technical bill and provides a good oversight, and I appreciate testifiers and the committee's time this morning.
Okay. Thank you so much. And now we have House File 1504.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning, Representative. You know, today is pie day, so we didn't get the pie. So,
the day's not over, Mr. Chair.
Please go ahead and present.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I'm pleased to be joined at the table today by Representative Haley, who carried the bill that established this program in 2017. The Youth Skills Training Program offers industry-related instruction and paid work experiences to high school students in high growth, high demand occupations. It does so by building community level partnerships between business and education, with community nonprofits playing as the intermediary role. And it does this in targeted industries, including advanced manufacturing, agriculture, automotive, healthcare, and IT industries. It sparked 50 partnerships across the state. And the demand for support for those partnerships is outstripping the supply of resources at this time. About 6 weeks ago, I was in Rochester for the STEM Forward event honoring the best STEM teachers in southeastern Minnesota. And I was there in a different role. I didn't mention that I was a legislator. I ended up at the table with a bunch of folks in Red Wing. And I said, so what's going well in schools in Red Wing? What's happening in the science, technology, engineering, and math area? These folks could not stop talking about the Youth Skills Training Program and what it has meant for students, what it's meant for employers, and the connections and the better vision that many students are able to develop of what path forward they want in their education and their careers. So I'm excited to carry the bill, but Representative Haley has on-the-ground experience. I appreciate her being here and sharing that.
Please proceed, Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dabney, for allowing me to partner with you on this bill. This has been an exciting project to work on, and to start something from scratch and see it come to fruition in my communities has probably been the most rewarding thing that I've accomplished thus far as a legislator. I'd like to point out three unique things, and then I'll turn it over to my testifiers who can really share the boots on the ground, literally, experience that they're having. First of all, one of the unique things in my district is that five schools partnered together to create a collaborative to do this and apply for one of the pilot grants. And I think that's unique and can be used throughout rural Minnesota when small schools in particular may not have the expertise, the time, and the resources to build one of these training programs. Secondly, industry and education partnering together isn't necessarily a natural collaborative. And the Youth Skills Training Grant has provided that opportunity to connect these dots and allow industry to partner with education and break down a lot of those silos and barriers that existed. A superintendent in our district in particular said that this has worked so well and they've learned so much in the past year that they are using this model to further all of their other career pathways programs. So, again, this is making exponential difference in getting students opportunities in their high school career. The third point I want to say is that, again, in these collaborations, it requires an intermediary. And I have to give credit in my district to an organization called Red Wing Ignite, which played that intermediary role. You all know that teachers have enough things on their plates, and so do school administrators. So you sometimes need a nonprofit or an intermediary person in the community to schedule the meetings, work on the grant applications, work through all the different barriers, and you'll hear about some of that from the testifiers this morning. And so another unique thing that these grants allow to happen. Lastly, I just want to say I'm very grateful for the Precision Manufacturing Association and the Department of Labor and Industry for all their work on it. This has truly been a public-private partnership, and the connection that the department has made with industry and all of our schools that have participated in the pilot has really been remarkable and something that we all can all be very proud of. I would now like to turn it over to my testifiers, Mitch Wedland, who is the work-based learning coordinator in the Red Wing School District, and two very exciting students, Tegan Sear and Reed Lohr.
Good morning and welcome. Please state your name and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Reed Lohr. I'm a junior at Red Wing High School, and I'm part of the first student cohort in the Learn and Earn program. For the past month and a half, every other morning, I go to Red Wing Shoes for 2 hours, learn about how they manufacture boots. I started at SB Foot Tanning Company, which is the shoes leather supplier, learn about the high-quality leather the shoes produce, how the high-quality leather the shoe uses is produced. Next, I followed the leather to the factory floor of Plant 2, and I have watched the leather that I helped to cut and sew as being made into a pair of boots. And in fact, the boots that are on my feet right now are ones that I helped to make. Mm-hmm. As I've been going through this process, I've seen positions that really spark my interest. For example, one major aspect of manufacturing is chemistry. And while touring the testing lab at SB Foot, my supervisor was explaining how they use a spectrophotometer to test the dyes they use on the leather. And this is really great to see because in my high school chemistry class, we did a lab that used a spectrophotometer to test a solution. And seeing the application of one of my interests in the leather manufacturing industry has given me a great perspective on what it would be like to choose chemistry as a career. And I don't think this would have been possible in the classroom setting. So far, I've really enjoyed my internship, and I'm sure I'll continue to enjoy it next month when I switch placements to SES elevators. I would also like to say that my experience has been made better by being a junior because I have another year in the internship to gain work experience that will shape what my life after high school will be like. As I begin the process of choosing a college, I'll be able to make a much more informed decision after talking to people who work in the fields that I'm interested in, as well as seeing the work that they do. I have a better understanding of what I would need to do to get where they are and what my life would be like if I did. I'm amazed at how much I've learned in this program, and I'm thankful that I've been given this opportunity. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Please welcome and proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My name is Tegan Sear, and I'm a senior at Red Wing High School. I'm part of the Learn and Earn pilot program as part of the Youth Skills Training Grant. At the beginning of the school year, I had no idea what I wanted to do after high school. I figured I would just go to college and figure that out when I got there. But when I heard about this new program that would have me in the workplace seeing and doing what real people do for a living, I immediately applied. I'm currently working at Hearth and Home Technologies, which is a fireplace manufacturer. I'm learning the entire manufacturing process from start to finish, all the way from prototype and development to packaging and installing. We are using all these skills to build our own mini fireplace that serves as a Bluetooth speaker that was designed just for this program by the research and design team. Many of the manufacturing steps are not something I thought I would enjoy, but now have sparked interest in. As I finish my placement at Hearth and Home, I have the opportunity to shadow the research and development team, which is a career I never even considered before my placement. This program has given me insight as to what I want to pursue in college and has influenced me to make more informed decisions on my future, which is something I could not have gotten in a classroom setting. At the beginning of April, I will start a new placement at 3M. I'm excited to see what they have in store for me. As one of the few people to join this program, I'm truly thankful. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Please state your name and proceed.
My name is Michael Wendland, and I'm the Work-Based Learning Coordinator at Red Wing High School. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to come and testify this morning about the great things that are happening down in Goodhue County. As you've heard from our two students, the opportunities that have been provided through the U Skills Training Grant have created unique and meaningful experiences. This program has not only helped students to be more informed about vocational possibilities, but also be better prepared for life after high school through exposure to community-based educational placements, working with adults, practicing those soft skills, and applying their knowledge from getting from their classes. These opportunities have been made possible this year by Red Wing Ignite, the local nonprofit, who took the lead to work with superintendents and employers to form the Goodhue County Collaborative, in which preparing for this grant. They convened in coordinated partnerships with area manufacturers and five school districts, which played a crucial role in establishing these worksite learning experiences. Each student had to apply to be in this first cohort and commit to completing an OSHA 10 certification and OSHA and soft skills training through Minnesota College State Southeast. In the first year, 20 students have been placed with a dozen regional businesses, and throughout the spring semester, each student will gain exposure to two different business locations and a wide range of vocations. Our employers have more than demonstrated how invested they are in this process to get in front of students, create exciting and educational opportunities by providing hands-on learning with experts in their respective fields. 30 more students will join the cohorts next year, so that we have a total of 50 students that will be running through the program in 2 years to help build our talent pipeline. What is exciting is that it's working. First, as you've heard from both Regan and Tegan, they are being exposed to vocations and opportunities that they never have heard about before in classrooms, and they get to meet with experts in the field to better understand what they look like. This, in turn, has helped students better understand career pathways they could go into after graduation, whether they pursue a four-year or two-year program or go straight into the workforce, which some of our seniors have already adjusted their plans from the beginning of the school year. What also has happened is that some of our students have been offered continued time outside of their internship hours and are being offered full-time employment after graduation. One student's been offered a large scholarship for engineering from one of the businesses, showing the long-term investment that these businesses have to be a part of this program to reach students and get them to come back and fill some of their local labor needs. The grant that Red Wing Ignite received to make this happen has been a positive experience for students across Goodhue County and has been the envy of many students. We had to turn away 15 students from our school that wanted to get in because we didn't have enough placements to get in. The efforts made by the employers, continued increased funding will reward the efforts made by the employers and connect more students with community-based educational opportunities. Through these type of innovative partnerships, we hope to fill some of our local labor demands and improve our educational programming to make our students more college and career ready as they make more informed and confident choices as they graduate high school. I want to thank the committee for taking the time to consider this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, one, first, I just want to say thank you to Representative Dabney and Representative Haley for this, for your vision. I think it's a good bill. I know personally for myself as a youth, I worked throughout high school, after school, and really creating a pathway so you can see career options. I think it's really good for youth. It's definitely a good alternative when we know college is becoming to be so unaffordable. Kids are, young folks are coming out in huge debt. So it's a good way to prepare you and also support a workforce that's looking for skilled folks to come in with the skills needed to produce. So as I was looking through the documents, I just wanted to make sure that it was a statewide effort. You know, rural is fantastic and great, but I think this would be something that is really good for a district like mine. And it helps me to now know about this so that I am also looking at the schools in my district to see how they're partnering with, you know, local businesses to prepare you for the future. So I don't have any questions. I just say I think it's a good bill. Those boots look pretty good there. Good job. But thank you for the bill.
Representative Dovney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moran, in just a moment we'll have a White Bear Lake testifier because of the program they have there. So it's definitely a statewide program. As I said, there are 50 partnerships around the state that are looking at this. So hopefully with some additional support from the legislature, we can expand its reach and its impact.
Yeah. Representative Kosny.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too appreciate the boots. You know, it'd be kind of nice to actually experience them personally with bringing them to the committee. I'm a size 8.5 or 9.
Something in a high top.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward. And you know, there's a little discussion in my district of a similar program. It's just getting off the start, but I think this grant program is a unique opportunity and a probably better way to have these types of programs funded a little bit more competitively, and we have some buy-in from our community as opposed to some direct appropriations that we see. So I appreciate that, and so I just want to kind of clarify my understanding of it, that it is kind of a competitive type grant that any community with a similar program that they're trying to get off the start can apply for. Is that correct?
Representative Dovney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kosnick, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, and I look forward to supporting this bill and the possible omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So we have another testifier.
Good morning, committee members.
Good morning. Please state your name and proceed.
I'm Amy Wallstein. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Precision Manufacturing Association. One of the problems that was getting in the way of attracting students to the manufacturing industry in Minnesota was that we simply couldn't get kids under 18 into experiential learning programs so that they could see what manufacturing is doing and trying it out for themselves. So you heard from the students from Red Wing today about how this program has helped them access what's known as student learner programs. Student learner programs are safe, mentored learning environments for students to be on the work site and directly supervised by an experienced person so that they are able to be safe and in a learning environment that helps them experience skilled industries like IT, manufacturing, agriculture, healthcare, and automotive. So throughout the state, we have seen programs pop up that are across the breadth of those different industries. And I do want to mention, yes, it is a statewide program, and there are conversations happening in school districts all over the state, including Minneapolis and St. Paul and Lakeville as well. There were 5 original pilots that were funded by through the Jobs Committee in the 2017 Omnibus Jobs Bill. And then there are 5 additional that are going to start in the next school year. So what we're looking for now is to expand the support for the programs that exist, as well as bring new programs online through the competitive grant process that is run through the Department of Labor. Employers are excited about this program because this is a way for them to directly engage in helping train youth, and they're participating and they're investing in these programs to help expand training for skilled work throughout Minnesota. So with me today is one of the manufacturing employers who is participating in the Gen Z Connect program in White Bear Lake. Justin, if you want to take it from here.
Please state your name and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Justin McPhee. I'm Vice President and General Manager of Moldcraft in Willerney, Minnesota, which is near White Bear Lake, Matamidi. We design and build plastic injection molds primarily for the medical industry, but also consumer products. For instance, the Scotch tape dispenser. We've built a dozen molds for 3M that you wrap your children's Christmas presents in every year. To medical stuff where we're replacing the lens in your eyeball with through cataract surgery. We're building the molds that mold those plastic parts. So I'm thankful for the support that you guys have provided thus far, and not just monetarily, but fundamentally recognizing the gap that there's not, that four-year college is not for every kid, and also that parents need to be involved in these decisions. And a lot of these programs have a parent aspect in them where they're involved in the initial meetings and the final wrap-up meetings, and allowing students to learn on our high-tech equipment at an age under 18 on a closely monitored situation, that our machines and shops are not dark, dirty, and dangerous. They're not like what they used to be. So one of the first points is the reason these funding opportunities are important. Many students don't get the opportunity to see industry. We're manufacturing specifically, but as they mentioned, there's also IT, healthcare. They don't get to see the machines that are used in the trade or have the pride of building something with their two hands. You heard the students behind us from Red Wing talk about building those boots and how cool that is and the excitement you heard in their voice. I went to Caston-Manorville High School in southeast Minnesota, just west of Rochester, and I didn't have the opportunities to see industry when I was in high school. Didn't have trades for classes. We didn't have these opportunities. And it's probably still like that, not only in small rural towns like that, but also in big cities. They don't have all those resources either. So these are can touch all walks of life in many different areas. So that's why why these opportunities are important. How has industry helped these students? So Moldcraft is, we're going to be in our third summer of the Gen Z Connection Program. Skills and careers in manufacturing. That's one of the main things that we want to talk about, is that it's a career. It's not just a job. It's a career, a living wage career of probably $70,000 is our average, $70,000-$75,000 of our employees at Moldcraft. That's a real living wage. It's been a great partnership with White Bear Lake Schools, Badness Heights Economic Development Corporation. There's been 8 to 12 companies that will be in it through this third year, and also Ramsey County has been involved. Gen Z Connection is a four-week program where a student gets to spend 1 week in four different companies. So it's 20 hours per week. We usually run the morning session, and they all four of these companies are vastly different, so they get a wide-angle view of what industry is. Like the students from Red Wing mentioned, now they're understanding what different manufacturing is because they're seeing so many different things. In addition to their time at our companies, there's also a career navigator involved in these that are teaching them soft skills like resume writing and interviewing skills and those types of things, along with the OSHA 10 certification. So at the mold, through the Moldcraft program, they built a mold just like this that molded a commemorative coin out of a dental epoxy that they got to engrave their name in it, and it was a very unique experience for them. They got to keep the mold plus the blueprints they created that helped build that mold. So they got to use CNC milling machines, sinker EDM machines, electrode manufacturing, wire EDM, all these specific processes used in advanced manufacturing. My third point is the partnership needs to be between industry, education, and the state. Industry like us needs to open our doors to provide the resources and experience for these students. Industry is investing between $2,000 to $9,000 per student in one of these sessions through materials, different training, lost productivity, paying the students. It's a real investment for industry, but we know how important it is. Moldcraft personally invested $25,000 last year to do our Gen Z program, not to mention my time organizing and coordinating and all those types of things. And then as a cap to all this, Moldcraft is also going to be offering a scholarship to a technical college for one of the students at White Bear Lake. So education needs to provide the opportunities for the students so that they can get out in the industry, because it needs to partner with industry and education. And the state helping with financial support for the recruiting efforts and the coordination. You can hear that the coordinating between the industry and education is very difficult and time-consuming, and that's a very important aspect. So one last thing in closing. At the end of one of our Gen Z closing ceremonies, we had an emotional mother up at the podium just thanking industry and the Venice Heights and the schools and how it changed their son's life and their vision of what it could look like after school. Where they would talk about what did they do at the Gen Z program that day. So the programs like this really make a difference, and I appreciate your time for listening to my story, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you so much. I know it's a great day when you hear you talk about research and development. So, Representative Kosnick.
You just saw that I had a comment, right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it should acknowledge, though, too, that the amount of the investment and time that the businesses are putting in towards these programs, you know, for a four-month program to have a student with you, you don't necessarily, I don't think, receive a return on that that's larger than the investment that the businesses are putting in there. Is that true? Other than, you know, you're getting students exposed to the program, but you're making a significant investment from your employees and time, and by the time the kids go back to school and that, you know, they're not totally productive and contributing, but the hope is that they may be future employees for you. Is that right?
Mr. McPhee?
Yes, this is Justin. Yes, it's actually a four-week, not a four-month.
Okay.
So it's a very short burst of just being exposed and seeing the different types of machines and the different job titles that employees have in the manufacturing industry.
I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for being a good partner in your community and investing in children to see these different opportunities and the significant investment that your company and other companies like you are making for the students in your community.
Ms. Wolstein?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, these are designed to be experiential learning mm-hmm. programs. Training does take is another step, but this is designed so that it kind of whets the appetite and sparks interest in these careers so that they can go on to an apprenticeship program, a two-year technical degree, or even a four or five, six-year engineering degree.
Thank you so much, Representative Devaney and Representative Haley, if you just wanted to conclude and renew your motion. Representative Cagle has got a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is probably to Representative Devaney or Representative Haley. Back in 2017, when the bill was first introduced or first passed, did the bill include any exemptions from child labor law so that they were able to operate the machinery?
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. There was a lot of work done with the Department of Labor and Industry so that we were working under the guidelines of child labor laws. We could talk a lot of detail about that, but there's actually a specific number of minutes and hours or time that they can spend on certain machines, and they can only be on, you know, machines where they are safe and monitored and mentored. So, yes, we are working within both state and federal guidelines.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please give us your final statement and renew your motion. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In education, we often observe that you can't be one if you can't see one, and that students need to be able to see themselves in their future and often need exposure beyond their immediate experience. Minnesota manufacturers, Minnesota industry is hungry for new employees, for new staff. As the students testified, they can now see themselves in different roles, and this program has expanded their horizon and connected their educational experience at the high school with future career possibilities. That's powerful for the students. It's also powerful for the manufacturers who are looking for new employees. It works for Minnesota communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, Representative Haley, any closing comments?
I urge your support.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to renew my motion for that House File 1504 be held over for a possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Thank you so much, Representative Devaney. House File 1501 has been renewed for possible inclusion. 1504 for possible inclusion in the division omnibus bill. With that, we do have the final bill for the day. Representative Jean. House File 650.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the House File 650 be laid over for consideration in the honors bill.
Thank you, Representative Chong. House File 650 has been moved for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for taking the time to hear my AmeriCorps Promise Fellow bill for the past 2 years. Minnesota Alliance with Youth has been running the AmeriCorps Promise Fellow program. Over 2,000 fellows have participated in the program, helping thousands of our youth throughout the state, across the state, over 80 school and community partners host AmeriCorps Promise Fellows, including Metro Districts, Minneapolis and St. Paul Public Schools, suburban sites such as White Bear Lake, Inver Grove High School Districts, Greater Minnesota sites like Hastings, Northfield, and Waconia Schools, and community-based organizations like the Senate Foundation and YMCAs. Through rigorous training, mentorship, and supervision, the AmeriCorps program has produced many alumni that have become teachers, counselors, and other educational support staff, some of whom you will hear from today. This is truly a pipeline to help with the education force shortage. This program is leading the work to keep at-risk students in school and on a pathway to graduation, and is preparing our future education workforce. I'm going to hand it off to Corey with the Minnesota Alliance Youth to talk more in details about this program and why we need to invest in it.
Please state your name and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Corey Redefending, and I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. And our organization has been proud to host the AmeriCorps Promise Fellow Program for the past 22 years, and I'm excited to be here today and testify in front of you. As Representative Zhang said, over 200 AmeriCorps Promise Fellows serving across Minnesota address the educational inequities we have in Minnesota and support students at risk of dropout by working to re-engage them in school and learning and putting them back on a path to high school graduation. The AmeriCorps Promise Fellows serving in our program are of remarkable talent and passion and come from diverse backgrounds. 46% of our members are people of color, and many are young professionals just beginning their careers. 86% are between the ages of 18 and 29. Nearly half of our AmeriCorps members come from the communities that they serve in Minnesota. We provide AmeriCorps Promise Fellows with extensive professional development and skills training as we ensure a pipeline of talent into the workforce. We use community building circles as a method to bring in the diverse voices and experiences of AmeriCorps members and provide space for them to process what they learn throughout the program. To support their interactions with students, Promise Fellows receive training in evidence-based strategies for establishing strong relationships with youth, goal setting, and motivational interviewing. Promise Fellows are trained in the Establish, Maintain, Restore method. EMR encompasses a series of strategies to help adults establish a strong relationship with students, maintain that relationship once established, and restore the relationship if needed. We also provide intensive training on trauma-informed ACEs training, collecting and using data, best practice sharing, self-care, and sustainability. Finally, we offer extensive personal and professional development focused on life after AmeriCorps, exploring careers, and we offer the opportunity for each member to work with a life coach. Each host site provides additional skill training to members, serving with them as a partnership approach that you will hear more about from some of our testifiers. We know that at both a statewide and national level, AmeriCorps has a significant impact on our workforce. Statewide, 70% of our host sites have hired their Promise Fellow after their term of service, and 86% of our host sites believe that the Promise Fellow program plays a role in creating a pipeline of more teachers in Minnesota. At a national level, 82% of AmeriCorps host organizations surveyed hired at least one AmeriCorps member. 42% of alumni employed within 6 months of service found a job through a connection made in AmeriCorps, and 8 out of 10 alumni say that AmeriCorps benefited their career path. The AmeriCorps Promise Fellow Program in Minnesota allows us to invest not only in students,
helping propel them to high school graduation and ultimately successfully enter the workforce, but to also provide intensive training and support to the members serving in our program to prepare them to enter the workforce and prepare for their careers in education, public service, and more. The impact on the individual members in their own growth and development extends well beyond them. The AmeriCorps Promise Wells we place at schools and community-based organizations statewide provide one-on-one group interventions to students showing early indicators of dropping out of high school. Our AmeriCorps Promise Wells serve as caring adults that provide the right support to the right students at the right time, changing their trajectories from one of potential school dropout to graduation success. Promise Fellows provided support to over 4,000 students, with 87% increasing their academic engagement. Just this week, the President's budget proposes to eliminate federal funding for AmeriCorps. Now, more than ever, is it important for Minnesota to demonstrate their commitment to this program and to our workforce. We have been supporting Promise Fellows for over 20 years, and this would be our first time we would receive state funding to support this program. Our request for $1 million of annual funding will allow the program to expand to new communities. As you saw on the map that we provided, while we are a statewide program, we are looking to expand this critical work more equitably throughout Minnesota. We ask for your support to make this happen. As an AmeriCorps alumni myself, I can tell you without a doubt that programs like this make a critical impact on our workforce and on our economy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I'm pleased to be joined by a number of testifiers who can share more about the impact of this program.
Please state your name and proceed, and other testifiers can move to the mic. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Colleen Keibel, and I'm the Director of Student Retention and Recovery in Minneapolis Public Schools. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you the experience Minneapolis Public Schools has had with AmeriCorps Promise Fellows serving in our district. Minneapolis Public Schools has partnered with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth for 7 years to bring AmeriCorps Promise Fellows into our schools. Our fellows serve students using an evidence-based intervention strategy called Tech and Connect to change the educational trajectory of our students who are at risk for dropping out. Without the service of these AmeriCorps members, many of our at-risk students would not receive the intensity and duration of support needed to succeed in school and reach graduation. AmeriCorps Promise Fellows, provided through our partnership with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, have served thousands of our struggling middle and high school students in 26 Minneapolis public schools. Our fellows exhibit strong skills in supporting teaching staff and administrators while advocating for students and families. Promise Fellows focus on rigorous academic standards and have high expectations for all students with respect to the student population they serve. The bombardment of messages about failure in low-income schools does not deter our Promise Fellows from regarding our students as culturally diverse, capable, motivated, resilient, and valuable members of their community. Our student population brings a variety of issues impacting their ability to succeed, including economic hardship, past academic failure, mental health needs, family and community violence, and homeless and highly mobile living situations. Promise Fellows work as partners with school social workers, counselors, teachers, deans, and community agencies. Promise Fellows receive ongoing support and training to strengthen their delivery of service from both Minneapolis Public Schools and the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. Our Promise Fellows work as advocates of restorative measures for students who are struggling in school, and they are a tremendous resource in problem-solving difficult situations with students, working to bring families, students, school staff, and community resources together to develop a plan to support students in reaching both academic and personal goals. This academic year, Minneapolis Public Schools has 18 Promise Fellows serving our district. The majority of them are recent college graduates. 9 are persons of color, 9 speak 2 or more languages, and all are trusted, caring adults to the students they serve. Our district does not view the partnership with the Minnesota Alliance and our AmeriCorps members as one way. We feel it is our obligation to serve each AmeriCorps Promise Fellow who commits to serving in Minneapolis Public Schools by providing ongoing professional development, opportunities for personal growth, and exploration and career interests following their AmeriCorps service term. The majority of our AmeriCorps Promise Fellows have gone on to complete graduate degrees following their service. I am pleased to share that many are now employed in our district and neighboring districts as teachers, school counselors, social workers, Check and Connect caseworkers, and student support staff. Thank you for the opportunity to share the positive impact AmeriCorps Promise Fellows have made in helping our Minneapolis public school students succeed and our district grow with educational professionals who started their careers by serving a community they care about as an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow member.
Thank you. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura Griffin, and I'm an associate educator working for the Check and Connect program at South High School. I began my professional career as a Promise Fellow, serving with Check and Connect at South during the 2015-2016 school year. I was then hired as an AE with Check and Connect and have continued to serve the South community until the present. The youth that I have the privilege of knowing at South have innumerable strengths and assets. They also face many barriers to educational achievement, including poverty, homelessness, structural racism. Often, because of the multiple demands put on teachers, they are unable to build meaningful one-on-one relationships with students who are often missing from their classes. In my role as a Promise Fellow, I was able to connect and learn from students and help them leverage their strengths to succeed in school. Through a service model with relationship building at its core, Promise Fellows are instrumental in advocating for student needs and working with youth to help navigate the school system and reach their own goals. As a young professional, being a Promise Fellow offered me a way to gain meaningful experience in the field of education. I began my year of service after graduating from college and returning to my home state of Minnesota. I had a passion for youth work, but few professional connections and little knowledge of the local education field. While serving as a Promise Fellow, I was able to build lasting connections with school staff and others in the education profession, building my knowledge and guiding my professional trajectory. In continuing to work at South, I have been able to maintain continuity with students and families beyond my 1 year of service and deepen my relationships to the school and the community. Serving as a Promise Fellow introduced me to working in the education field and gave me countless opportunities to grow as a professional. As I built relationships with students and learned more about the barriers they face to high school graduation, I began to wonder how I could use my career to work towards greater equity in the education system. Among the many examples of school staff seeking to improve the lives of students, social workers stood out to me as the ones with a unique set of tools to work directly with students while also challenging systemic barriers to student success. Since my year of service, I've gone back to school to pursue a dual master's degree in social work and public policy at the University of Minnesota. I hope to continue to work in both direct service and systems change in order to make our education system more responsive to youth and to address the racism and inequity embedded in our educational system. Serving as an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow helped me to learn the skills to be responsive to students and families and gave me the drive to work towards educational equity in our school systems. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Zhang, we have 5 minutes. Do you have other testifiers? All right, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Katie Lovren, and I served as an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow during the 2015-2016 school year in Northfield, Minnesota, at the Tackling Obstacles and Raising College Hopes program, TORCH. As a Promise Fellow, I worked with students individually, providing academic advising and connecting them with school and community resources, and I also had the opportunity to facilitate some groups. Thanks to this range of experiences, I ended my term of service feeling well-equipped to begin my professional social work career. My year as a Promise Fellow turned out to be critical for my own career pathway. Like many other Promise Fellows, I was ultimately hired by my host site. In August of 2017, I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to return to TORCH as director of the middle school TORCH program. I've since had the privilege of supervising AmeriCorps Promise Fellows, including current Promise Fellows Alana Daniel and Saul Hernandez, working alongside the 8 other Promise Fellows working at multiple school and community host sites in Northfield. Though TORCH focuses on high school graduation and participation in post-secondary education, we lay the groundwork starting in middle school. TORCH starts working with youth at the beginning of their 6th grade year with the goal of promoting academic and socio-emotional skills needed for high school, college, and beyond, and providing opportunities for college and career exploration so that students start envisioning and setting goals for their futures. Our AmeriCorps Promise Fellows are truly at the heart of making this work possible. They engage with students, build relationships, provide academic support, and connect them to out-of-school time programming. As a supervisor, I have the opportunity to see the positive impact of AmeriCorps Promise Fellows. There are role models for our students. They're positive, encouraging, and determined to support students to reach their full potential. Most importantly, they don't give up, even when students might be hesitant to engage with school or staff. Their persistence and positivity ensure our students feel a sense of belonging and know they have caring adults who they can go to at school. The Promise Fellow Program also serves as a talent pipeline, providing a connection to employment within the community. Of the 10 Promise Fellows who served in Northfield last year, 5 are now employed by local AmeriCorps host sites or partner organizations. Of the 10 who are currently serving, at least 3 have already committed to a second year of service in Northfield. We are fortunate that many of our Promise Fellows ultimately go on to work for local schools and nonprofit organizations, continuing to share their skills and talents to the benefit of our community. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak, and thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you. Please state your name and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Denicia Parker. Please excuse my voice. I'm coming down with something. I'll try to read this fast. To be honest, high school was a struggle for me. I was failing nearly all my classes when I first encountered Promise Fellows. Because of the volunteering opportunities provided by my Promise Fellow mentor, Kelly Timian, I took a strong interest in community service and development. So strong, I was awarded most volunteer hours submitted by a student for 2 years in a row, along with a Red Wagon Award for the completion of the Hope Closet, which is a resource providing household essentials, food, clothes, and infant products to my peers, all done with the support of my Promise Fellow. A week after my graduation, I was hired at Youth Pass to serve as a Promise Fellow at the organization. It's a nonprofit intermediary that has 3 focus areas: as learning and leadership, economic opportunity, health and safety. Since I have gained facilitation experience in research, philanthropy, design thinking, and policy, all youth-led, and its expertise, I've been able to implement at my current position as youth engagement manager at the nonprofit that I was originally serving my Promise Fellow term with. Still working at Youth Pies, the organization I was connected to 6 years ago during my term, I am committed to providing technical assistance to youth of color who wish to sustain economic resilience using their passions. Using innovative strategies, I hope to build the skill and financial capacity for young creatives to develop their ideal professional career. I also hope that Promise Fellows are provided with the funding they need to recreate stories like this and sustain the impactful influences they make on students they connect with.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have one quick question from Representative Pego, and then we'll go to Jim Dapp. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of curious about the difference between Fellows and Vistas, and then if the Fellows also get the traditional AmeriCorps benefits like the education awards and stipends and things like that.
Ms. Redfin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. AmeriCorps Vistas provide capacity building support, and AmeriCorps Promise Fellows provide direct service. So that's really the distinction in terms of the role. And then they do, I appreciate the question, because AmeriCorps Promise Fellows, upon completion of their term of service, do receive an education award that's provided by the federal government. That's just under $6,000 and can be used to repay any student loans they have. If they're just starting their education, can be used directly as tuition.
Thank you.
I talk about that in mine, too.
Yep.
Representative Devaney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zhang, thank you for bringing this forward today. I just want to fill out for committee members some of the what you just heard. The Northfield Torch Program is a highly respected program, particularly yielding opportunities and better outcomes for the Latinx population in Northfield, which has been growing. So connecting with those kids and building opportunity there. The Minneapolis representative referred to Check and Connect, which is a program that identifies kids who are stumbling at ninth grade, because we know that if you stumble at ninth grade, you're a lot less likely to graduate high school. And it works with them, holds them, and supports them through high school graduation. It requires somebody like an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow who has the the skills and the ongoing professional development to work with those young people, but also has the flexibility in their school schedule. The teacher can't do it because they've got 35 other kids and 180 more throughout the day. The social worker has different demands. The Promise Fellows are the key people to build the relationship with those kids and have the flexibility in their schedule. And then we see this as a workforce development program because we see these Promise Fellows who are more diverse than the teaching corps in the building moving on to take those teachers' positions when they retire. So it's key workforce development both for the youth served and the youth serving. So, Representative Zhang, thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Really quick. Representative Zhang, I also would like to say thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a good bill. Chair Daphne, everything you said has convinced me that we need to invest in this.
It's a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Moran. Representative Zhang, if you wanted to provide us the closing remarks and renew your motion.
I think I have two more
testifiers. Oh. We're time. We can read fast.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen about this bill. My name is Paige Lacroix, and I had the pleasure of serving 2 years as an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth at Oakland Junior High in Stillwater, Minnesota. During my 2 years of service, I was able to work with over 100 students, either on my caseload, part of the AVID program, or as members of our cultural diversity club known as STAND. I want to take you back to the last few weeks of my senior year in college. It was spring, and the weather was warming up, and after applying for what felt like hundreds of jobs, I had not received as much as a phone interview with anyone. Early on in my undergrad, I decided to go into school counseling, which meant grad school was inevitable. With the amount of debt I had already accumulated, I found myself only applying for jobs with the potential for reduced or discounted tuition. After a particularly intense breakdown with my dad on the phone, he emailed me a link to an opportunity that seemed to check all of the boxes I needed to fill at that time in my life. Being a Promise Fellow meant my student loans would be in deferment, I'd be awarded money for grad school, and I'd get to be in a school making sure this was the right career path for me. I applied immediately. Within a week, I was accepted, had chosen a host site, added numerous contacts to my network, and finally had an answer to everyone's question, so what's next? For me, serving with AmeriCorps not only solidified my career in school counseling, the experience taught me skills that I will take with me to every job I hold in the future. Skills like relationship building, data tracking, teamwork, leadership, critical thinking, and professional etiquette are all things that I walked away with after my years of service. During my second year of service, a student came to me looking for help. Her teacher had told her about the Minnesota Youth Council, and she was desperate to apply, but was in need of an adult partner. Honored and hardly thinking I was worthy of the term adult, I agreed. Today, Fatima is ending her third year as a member of the Minnesota Youth Council and is wrapping up her senior year of high school. During that time, she has continued to inspire me with her assertiveness, passion, strength, and eloquence for the issues that matter most to her. I'm confident in saying that our relationship would not exist if not for the Promise Fellow program. I have no doubt that without having the option to serve as an AmeriCorps Promise Fellow, I would probably be stuck in a cubicle dreaming of what I'm doing right now. Although I am no longer serving.
Thank you so much. I think we want to give Fatima the quick remarks. She's on the, because we have already 5 minutes.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry. Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for taking the time to review and listen to the Promise Fellow funding bill. My name is Fatima Manawa, and I'm a senior at Stillwater Area High School. For the last 3 years, I have served on the Minnesota Youth Council as a member of the policy committee, and I also serve as an alliance board member as well. Mr. Chair, if 3 years ago you had told me that I would be so involved, I would not have believed it. As the students have always had drive, whether it be academic or social, I had so much to say, but no confidence to express myself in a way that would have an impact. There are so few spaces in which youth voice are not only represented, but heard. And for someone like me, a black female immigrant, that was hard. Growing up in mostly white schools in which I was a minority and therefore never fully understood or represented, I grew into the belief that my voice was not essential to the conversation, and that is so dangerous for anybody, especially at such a young age. To be so young and still figure out who you are while being so different from everyone in your day-to-day life, including the adults, that was bad, you know? Who understands you? Who do you go to with problems? Who speaks out for you? The answer for me was nobody. So many of my friends and teachers did not understand what it is to be black, to move to a different country, to live in a home with only one parent who works overtime all the while going to school. So many aspects of my culture and history, who I was as a person, were strange to my classmates, which led to teasing and bullying. I now realize my classmates weren't malicious, just kids who were ignorant of the differences in humans, but that ignorance has impacted so much of my life. That ignorance led to years of confusion, sadness, hatred, and the constant feeling that I was somehow inferior, missing out in some way because I wasn't born blonde and blue-eyed. It affected how I interacted with people, my trust in adults and authoritative figures to relate to me and protect my value as a black student. That ignorance stole my ability to self-advocate and ask for understanding. That ignorance stole my voice. My eighth grade year, I was introduced to Promise Fellows through my school's AVID program. We had four Promise Fellows, but we shared them with another school, so two stayed with us regularly. I remember being so excited because that year one of our Promise Fellows was a black man. I know how absurd that sounds, but then again, this is my eighth year as a student, and in all those years, I had never once been in a school where a teacher or even any staff member in general looked like me. It was shocking, and in a way, so empowering for him to just be there. Could you imagine being so used to not seeing an adult who reflects you that just the mere fact that exists empowers you? It seems so silly, but that was the start of my journey. It all started with Promise Fellows, and that was just the beginning. And I've got a bit more, but I'm just going to go to skip to the end because I feel like...
You can also submit that in writing to the members, so if you have the final remarks, so we can conclude.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the time.
Okay. As a member of the policy committee, I have learned to take risks, make decisions, and stand by them, sink or swim. And I have done it all with my adult partner, Paige, who I met through the AVID program while she was serving as a Promise Fellow. I now serve on the council and the board of directors. And to be honest, I have no one to thank but my Promise Fellows. With them, I have been exposed to and been part of so much. I have been encouraged, supported, and shown what genuine service is. Mr. Chair, when reading this bill and going home tonight, I hope you know this. Funding the Promise Fellow isn't just funding a group. It's funding hope, support, and courage, the importance of self-advocacy, and the involvement within the community. It's funding the next angry little girl who just wants to matter.
Thank you so much. With that, I think the representative renews his bill.
We renew my motion that House File 650 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Robert.
It's a good bill. Thank you so much. With no further issues. So.